Hello, and welcome to the BCMA podcast. I'm Ben Fast, and here at the BCMA, we're almost finished putting together a great team of content contributors and volunteers for this new podcast. You'll hear the team's work starting with next month's episode. So until then, we wanted to share some bonus content from our time at the Museums and the Web Conference, held in Vancouver this past April. In this special bonus episode, you'll hear some of the lightning talks presented on the Saturday morning, and since this was recorded live in the hotel ballroom, please forgive the occasional microphone pops or computer sounds. These 5-minute presentations are meant to give you a quick, high-level, and often fun look at some of the coolest projects going on in the museum world today. We'll start with two projects from south of the border. First up is Diana Pan from the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. She presented the results of a very useful, very practical implementation of technology in the museum's lobby, self-serve ticketing kiosks. After Diana's talk, you'll hear Rob Rothfarb from the Exploratorium in San Francisco, who brought the recent solar eclipse to the palm of America's hand through livestream content and hosted educational videos. What's better than building engagement with space science and some very excited hosts?
Good morning. I'm Diana Pan with MoMA. Today I'm going to be sharing some very concrete results from a pilot project that we implemented over the last year to solve a very practical problem, which is simply crowding in our lobby. So we looked at self-service kiosks for a long time, and really it's something that's ubiquitous now. You see them everywhere, in movie theaters and at your bank, airports, but you don't see them so much in the museum sector. And whether it's because of aesthetics or simply the cost of implementing something like that and the maintenance, you don't see it that much. Or in the case of MoMA, just the general resistance against something that we felt went against our desire to be a very high touch and trying to give a very personalized experience to all of our visitors. So we implemented a pilot project, and as our founding director, Alfred Barr, noted and saw MoMA as a laboratory inviting the public to participate, he was probably referring more to the art than the lobby and basic ticketing transactions. But we in technology interpreted it differently. So we implemented these prototype kiosks as a proof of concept. And proofs of concepts is something that we do frequently as a form of experimentation at the museum in order to show the value of something that a theory that we have. We wanted to create a new channel for selling tickets, while we also know that we could look at online ticketing as another form to deal with the crowding issue. We've spent a number of years trying to move the needle and have done our best to raise it to maybe about 10% of conversion online. So we knew that we needed to look for other ways of getting people to purchase tickets outside of the focused ticketing area within our lobby. So we wanted to test a self-service kiosk that also bridged what looked like online in our lobby. So the user interface and the UX looks exactly like online, except now it's in a kiosk form. So if visitors did their research online and looked at ticket prices and hours and then came to the lobby and used the kiosk, it's exactly the same experience. And we looked at a goal of reducing overall traffic congestion also as MoMA went into this multi-year expansion project where we'll be increasing our gallery space by about 30%. We knew that with a lot of people coming into the lobby, we needed to make sure that there were as many possible options for ticket purchases. And whether kiosks would be successful in this prototype project would inform whether we should have them once we reopen. So as a proof of concept, we looked at very concrete metrics because we're very data-oriented at MoMA. We looked at up the kiosk's orders as a total percentage of total orders and as well as revenue. We built the kiosk so that they're relatively mobile, so we wanted to try it in different locations. We looked at average transaction time and just general success or failures where if people didn't complete their transaction. And also we implemented it in 10 different languages, so we were interested to understand what languages people were interested in using transactions for. Okay, so here's some pictures from our tests. So we placed it in a fairly high trafficked area within the museum in this hallway underneath the escalator. And what we saw was that it was very well used. While online received around 10% plus or minus 2%, we saw that even three or four kiosks in this hallway brought in 26% on the very first day. However, there was traffic congestion. People started to line up behind the kiosk, so it created its own congestion issue. So we moved it into this area in front of this beautiful space where you could see into our sculpture garden. And we saw that it was even more successful, in fact. It brought in 33% of our ticket orders. And one of the reasons is because you see it immediately as you come into the entrance of the museum. And as soon as people see it, they don't know if there's another place to get tickets, so they all line up. But one of the challenges which we felt as an institution is that it blocked the view of our garden, so we quickly moved them away. And then we decided to try the kiosks out at different locations, so we put it at one of our other entrances on 54th Street, which is not as well trafficked. I would say about 15% of our visitors come in through that entrance, so it really wasn't used that much. And finally, we moved it into an area where it was in equal view. When a visitor walked in, they saw both the kiosks and the ticketing desks at the same time, allowing them to choose whether they want to use a machine versus talk to a person. And there it stands. It currently receives about 25 to 30% of our orders. And a summary of data over the last 6 months show that people do use it. It's 30% of them are non-English. Transaction times are about 30 seconds because it's a very, very simple, basically about a three-step process. High conversion, 25 to 30%, and revenue is 35 to 40%. And in terms of conclusion, we're seeing that they are effective, proving the concept. And that people actually choose to use the kiosk frequently, even when there's no line at the desk. So it just creates a new, more inclusive way of letting people do what they want in terms of transaction. And it allows us to potentially redistribute some of our visitor agents across the museum within the lobby to welcome people and continue to give that high touch experience both in the lobby and in the galleries. Thank you.
So next up is Rob Rothfarb.
Thanks, Ben. Hi, I'm Rob Rothfarb. I'm Online Media Project Director at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. From space to your phone, the total solar eclipse right into your pocket on your smart device. Since 1998, the Exploratorium's been mounting expeditions to the Path of Totality to bring live images of the sun during total solar eclipse. With the sponsorship of NASA in 2016 and 2017, we mounted expeditions to the Western Pacific, a small atoll in Micronesia called Wolyai, and in 2017 for the Great American Total Solar Eclipse that crossed the country from west to east coast, we mounted an expedition to Madras, Oregon and Casper, Wyoming. With each production that we do, we try to expand our reach and understand how we can better connect with audiences worldwide. For 2017, we included 2 3-hour telescope-only live streams from our remote locations, as well as 2 1-hour educational hosted programs, one in English and one in Spanish, both with live closed captioning. We also included a really wonderful work created by Wayne Grimm, a staff member at the Exploratorium, who created a beautiful sonification of the live video of the eclipse, combined with live accompaniment from the Kronos Quartet performing at our museum in San Francisco. We publish our eclipse streams on our website, and this year on NASA's website, and for the first time also YouTube Live and on Facebook. Take a quick look at some of the images.
Sky there. There's the diamond ring.
There's
effect.
The diamond ring.
And now the light is coming back.
Good luck, Casper, with your totality.
I see the planets.
Yep, the corona is so bright.
Oh my God.
I see streamers stretching out at about 2 o'clock and 7 o'clock.
We have a few wispy clouds up in the sky, but they're not really blocking anything.
The temperature, it's dropped, I'm gonna guess at least 8 or 10 degrees.
We're seeing some very beautiful chromosphere on our images. We're seeing the U shape that the magnetic fields is as they're shaping the plasma. This is so amazing. This is so surreal.
I think I'm actually crying, so it was the best thing I've ever seen.
I was excited because I knew it was going to be dark even though it wasn't night.
To build excitement for the eclipse and to get the program into people's hands, we decided to extend our online work by creating dedicated mobile apps for iOS and Android. We began in 2016 and iterated on our process in 2017 by redesigning the app and adding more features. The goal for the app was to create an optimized viewing experience, especially one that would allow easy switching between the different live programs. The app also included 35 on-demand educational programs, providing everything from safe sun viewing techniques about our eclipse expeditions, an upcoming NASA solar probe mission, and our archives of past eclipses since 1998. A key feature that we pushed on was to use the capability of the mobile device to let people know when the program would start, so that wherever they were in the world, they would be notified and find out exactly when to watch. A countdown helped build excitement, and integrated Twitter allowed people to share their preparation and excitement for the eclipse as well as images that they were capturing live and sharing them directly from the app. Push notifications turned out to be really exciting. We were able to send out notifications in advance during our expedition as we were setting up and building excitement to let people know what it was like to travel to the path of totality to get ready to capture live images of the sun and key moments during the eclipse. Also, practical things like when a replay would be available. Being able to extend our reach into the mobile app stores was particularly important, and being featured in this case by Apple drove tremendous traffic to the app. How did we do it? We made a native app for iOS and Android, which integrated the Brightcove native SDK and a number of other tools to provide different features. Creating the program and transmitting it from multiple locations was actually way more complicated, but this gives you a sense of the distribution of the signal path, including satellites, fiber optics, social media channels, and video distribution partners. Our peak live viewing on the app was 90,000 on the day of the eclipse last summer, with 230,000 users in the month of August. Users reported very easy video viewing and being able to switch between the different programs that we offered. We really learned that continuing to push into the app space was a good option for mobile viewing, in particular of a live event like this, and showed tremendous promise for continuing the potential of reaching people through online and mobile devices. Thank you.
What cool projects by Diana and Rob? While both MoMA and the Exploratorium may be a bit larger than your museum, you can also use audience data, iterative design, and some adaptable technology to improve your visitor experience and reach out to new audiences. The BCMA is excited to be bringing lightning talks to our annual conference for the first time this year. Join colleagues from across BC in Kelowna from October 21st to 23rd for sessions, workshops, networking, and yes, lightning talks from some of the best and brightest minds in our sector. There will also be a special Indigenous Cultural Competencies pre-conference workshop on October 21st. All the information about conference and how to register is available now on our website under the conference tab. You'll also see information about travel bursaries, being a conference volunteer, and coming soon our conference program. Visit bit.ly/BCMACONFregister to get your tickets. Early bird pricing is on now until July 14. But now, back to the Museums on the Web conference for two more lightning talks. First up, you'll hear from Vancouver-born Naomi Satius as she describes her work with the newly opened London Mithraeum, a tech-heavy, immersive archaeological museum. If you want to see some amazing footage from the original archaeological dig, the current construction, and the new museum experience, visit londonmithraeum.com. After Naomi's talk, you'll hear the voice of the panel's first presenter, Kelly Skelton, from the Auckland War Memorial Museum in New Zealand. Kelly gives an overview of Future Slam, an initiative to bring staff together to learn about new technology across the museum, with a little help from tasty kiwi snacks.
Hello. I am Naomi Satius, and I'm a senior project manager with Local Projects, and today I'm going to talk about a new immersive archaeology museum that opened in downtown London this past November called the Ancient Temple of Mithras. But first, a little bit about Local Projects. We are an interpretive experiential design firm located in Manhattan in New York City. Our design studio is comprised of about 60 people spanning a wide range of disciplines, including architects and designers, creative technologists, devs, content developers, strategists, and project managers, of which I am, from really all around the world, and I, in fact, am from here in Vancouver originally. Our studio has been involved with designing numerous significant interpretive projects, including the 9/11 Memorial Museum, the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum, the Museum of the City of New York, amongst others. And although we are called Local Projects, we are really engaged in projects around the world. However, this local orientation is really a philosophy that's about investigating the local context for each project, and that is certainly the case with the project that I am here presenting today, the Temple of Mithras. So this particular story actually starts about 70 years ago during the Second World War, when London was bombed during the Blitz and about a third of the city was destroyed. As London was starting to rebuild, an archaeologist by the name of Walter Grimms convinced the landowner to let him dig around as part of the reconstruction, and on his very last day, he discovered a wall, and this would become one of the most famous Roman discoveries of 20th century London. As they continued to dig, an almost complete footprint started to emerge of a particularly well-preserved wall along one of London's lost rivers called the Walbrook, which is an underground tributary to the Thames. And the river actually had marked the city limits of old Londinium nearly 2,000 years ago. What had actually been uncovered was something called a Mithraeum, which was a Roman temple devoted to the god of Mithras that had been built about 1,800 years ago. And it immediately became a huge public sensation, drawing thousands of visitors. Basically, what Mithras was a religion that had arose during the Roman Empire around the same time that Christianity was sprouting around Europe. But after much debate, in order to make way for rebuilding, the site was excavated, and this was actually relocated a few hundred meters away. Fast forward half a century, and Bloomberg LP acquired the site and started working with Foster and Partners to design and build a new European headquarters. And as part of the project, Bloomberg agreed to deconstruct the 1960s installation and reconstruct the temple back on its original footprint, several layers below the current street level. And really, during this dig, over about 1,400 archaeological objects were discovered. So local projects came on board about 5 years ago as the design lead for the project, with really the challenge of creating an immersive experience that would turn Roman archaeology into something engaging and surprising for general public visitors. So this journey, which just opened in November, begins at street level with thematically curated contemporary artists' interpretation of place, and provides a high-level introduction to the contextual history of the site, the cult of Mithras, and includes a large artifact case with rare relics that may have actually been used in ceremonies on the site. Visitors then quickly descend next to a wall that brings them back to the original city levels of ancient Londinium. So they're really traveling back in history. And as visitors reach the lower level, they are offered clues into the mysteries of Mithras and enter a room that allows for contextual dives into specific artifacts. Surrounding them is immersive media, interactive technology that encourages deeper interpretation, along with audio from leading archaeologists who explain the mysteries of religion. And really, once they're armed with this interpretive layer, they're then ready to move into the reconstructed temple itself, which is really left as a more emotional experience of the original ruins. And this is where our production uses light, fog, and Latin chanting audio to create 3D holograms of the original site on top of the ruins. And this is the experience.
Nama Persis tutela lune.
Nama Patri tutela Saturni.
Nama Heliodromis tutela solis.
Nama Patri tutela Saturni.
And the immersion fades, and visitors are left with the archaeological ruins and their own imaginations for a few minutes before exiting. And as they ascend back up the stairs into present-day London, we hope that they leave with a new sense of the layered local heritage made possible through contemporary innovation. Thank you.
All the way from Auckland, Kelly Skelton.
Tēnā koutou katoa. I'm Kelly Skelton. I'm the head of digital experience at Tāmaki Paengahira, Auckland War Memorial Museum in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I'm delighted to be here today to bring you a slice of an event series we've been running internally just for staff, called Future Slam. So the Rocky Road slice is really relevant as we serve it at one of at the events, so it's one of the major draw cards. I actually brought some all the way over from New Zealand, so wait till the end, and if we've got time, you might just get it. The Rocky Road is also a really interesting metaphor for how we navigate digital and technology. Sometimes the road can be rocky. There's so much noise about technology and disruption. There's AR, VR, MR, IoT, AI, cyborgs, to name just a few. What does it all mean? And how do we, as digital professionals, help cut through all the clutter and support our colleagues within our organisations to get on board? Well, that's where Auckland Museum's Future Slam event series comes in. It's once a month, it's 1 hour long, and it's just for staff, and we have about six or eight sessions each year. We lure people in with food. All staff are invited, and we get about 60 attendees each event. We video the sessions for staff who can't attend so they can watch them afterwards. We have a mix of external and internal speakers who are specialists in their field. And we mix up the format. So sometimes we do talks, we do demos, we do panel sessions, and some group workshop activities. So we started the series in 2016 as the Digital Ideas Brewery, and we just had internal speakers. The topics included 3D scanning, printing, digital content creation, virtual reality, and collections imaging. And at the end of 2016, we asked colleagues how they'd found the series. We got really, really positive feedback. So staff really enjoyed the chance to explore technology and digital trends with colleagues and other teams. The Rocky Road was a hit. They did, however, feel that the purpose of the sessions was unclear, and there was a little bit too much idea generation, and there were some frustrations around this. So we rebranded to Future Slam, and we removed the expectation around ideas generation, and we set some really clear objectives and a structure for the year ahead. So we had four key objectives. And the gist of this really is to enable and encourage digital thinking across the whole organisation. We planned out the program for 2017. So the first part was introducing the tech, and we invited external experts in to explain and demo the technology and show how it's being used, both in museums and also in a wider context. Then part two was focused on the future and how might future audiences interact with the museum and consume content. We felt it was a really successful program and a solid year, but we needed feedback from staff again, so we ran another survey. And these are a few bits of feedback. So people really valued the big picture thinking, the introduction to new technologies, and us bringing external specialists into the museum to present. Many spoke of being more confident and feeling more informed about technology and digital. And that's great, because that's really what we were hoping to achieve by running the series. We also asked what topics they'd like covered at Future Slams this year. And so we're using all of this feedback to help inform this year's program. We're also looking at possibly extending the audience beyond only museum staff, as we've had a lot of interest from the GLAM community in Auckland. So it's exciting times ahead. So I thought I'd share some tactics for success for running a successful program. So planning is really key. Just set your objectives and plan the program early, and just start small to get something off the ground if it makes sense to do that. Advertise the events internally, talk to colleagues, get them excited and interested. Make sure you ask them what they want before you start the program. And then throughout the series, get feedback. Make sure they're getting value and change what's not working. Find good speakers, whether they're internal or external. Brief them really well so they understand the objectives, the format and the timings, all of that stuff. And then balance the format of the sessions during the season. So do talks, presentations, workshops, demos, mix it up so it doesn't just become the same. Finally, lure them in with tasty treats. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa.
Future Slam was definitely the coolest named project at the conference. And I'm not just saying that because Kelly gave me a pack of Rocky Road. What local sweet treats could you use to get your staff to learn together? Let us know by visiting our Facebook or Twitter accounts at BC Museums ASSN. It was great to see these international museum colleagues present their projects and work at the Museums on the Web conference right here in BC. A special thanks to our speakers today, Diana Pan, Rob Rothfarb, Naomi Satius, and Kelly Skelton. Thanks also to Nancy Proctor, Rich Cherry, Hiroko Kusano, and Titus Bricknell for letting us record a lightning talk session at the conference. We hope you come back and do another one here soon. As I already mentioned, early bird registration for the BCMA's annual conference, happening this year in Kelowna, is open now until July 14th. Reserve your spot by visiting bit.ly/BCMACONFregister. Conference runs from October 21st to 23rd, and you will find all the information on attending, including volunteer and bursary options, on our website. We'll be back with a full episode and our new podcast team at the end of July. You can subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and be the first to hear new episodes. The BC Museums Association receives operational support from the BC Arts Council. We also gratefully acknowledge the support of the Royal BC Museum in providing a home for the BCMA Secretariat. The BCMA Secretariat is located on the traditional lands of the Songhees and Esquimalt First Nations.